Welcome to this lunch påfyll event that takes place in Pilesede 52, the area which will be the future university library in a couple of years. My name is Lars Egeland, and I'm director of the university library. Today we will talk about past and present pandemics. The event is part of OsloMet's marking of the World Mental Health Day, which really was on October 10th. World Mental Health Day this year focused on the lives during and after a pandemic. How did Norwegians cope during the COVID-19, and what can we learn from future pandemics? And to answer this, we have a great panel of OsloMet researchers with us from PANSOK, which is the Center for Research on Pandemics and Society. PANSOK is led by Sven-Erik Mamelund, who is also here today, and he recently became professor in pandemic studies. Congratulations for that. Now we'll hear from the three researchers, and afterwards there will be an opportunity to ask questions. Jessica Dimka, who is the co-leader of PANSOK, will talk about the 1918 influenza pandemic and the mental health consequences. Afterwards, Carla Hjorth will give her presentation. She is working on a master thesis about the Spanish flu and suicide. She will present her preliminary results. We know that rich people are more happy than poor people. Healthy people are more satisfied with their lives than people with health issues. People that live in families are more happy than people living alone. But what happened with Norwegians that did not score on any of these happiness indicators during COVID-19? Nanso Bakkeli from SIFO will tell us about that. First, Jessica, the floor is yours.
Thank you for coming, and thank you for recording, if people who are watching on the recording. So to start us off, I wanted to first think about underlying mental health as a risk factor during pandemics. It's pretty easy to understand or guess why you might have more severe cases or deaths if you have an underlying health condition for both biological and social reasons. So I'm going to very briefly highlight some of the work we've done on that topic. As indicated by the title here, this is a published paper that we've done. To my knowledge, it is the first and still the only publication that looked at disability as a risk factor during the 1918 flu. And particularly, we were looking at mental health disparities. So in this paper, we compared records of illnesses and deaths and of staff and patients at 7 different psychiatric institutions in Norway. These records were kept by the directors of the institutions at the request of a researcher at the time. And accounting for age, sex, and the institution they were at, the staff were more likely to get ill. So roughly 53% of the staff had a case of flu during this pandemic versus about 24% of the patients. But only one staff member died, and that's about 1%. And instead, about 10% of the patients died, or 30 of them. So there was this kind of interesting crossover in terms of risks. We've also looked at Swedish parish records. So Swedish priests at the time of these parishes were required to keep very detailed records about the people who were residing there. And working with the Center for, oh, I'm going to get this wrong, so I'm not going to even say it, people at the Umeå University at CEDAR is the abbreviation, Demographic and Aging Research, I believe it is. Working with them, they have this massive database of demographic records, and we retrieved over 22,000 people living in 9 parishes between 1918 and 1920. And they had records including dates of death, causes of death, and whether or not they had disabilities. So we compared the people who were non-disabled versus were disabled to see if they had different rates of death during the pandemic. And broadly speaking, skipping over a whole bunch of statistics here, the people who were disabled were more likely to die than the people who were non-disabled if they were institutionalized. But looking specifically at the different types of disabilities, the people with psychiatric or intellectual disabilities also were more likely to die regardless of their institutionalization status. So even people just living in the communities. Similarly today, with COVID-19 and other epidemics, we can see big disparities for people with mental health and intellectual disabilities, and as also people who are living in institutions like nursing and care homes. But our focus today is more on the opposite direction, right? The impacts on mental health of pandemics. And so while I was working on the data collection for the previous studies, examples like these that I came across in various records did suggest there might be effects of illness or the pandemics on mental health. And these were from a report on the psychiatric institution system. These are roughly translated with the help of Google about the mental health conditions within one family. And as we see here, two children within the family had different types of mental health conditions, different experiences with that. And as a result of having the flu, they became more affected, and in one case, died. Of course, these are just anecdotes. I also saw a couple anecdotes of people whose psychiatric symptoms improved as a result or during the infection of the flu. And there are potentially many reasons why we might expect to see mental health impacts of pandemics. These are just a few of them, kind of brainstorming to get things going. None of us here are medical clinicians. We can't talk about the biological pathways and mechanisms of things, but there is evidence that there's direct effect of the virus, for example, on nervous tissue, on autoimmune responses, on hypersensitivity responses. Perhaps in rare cases, medications and treatment can have effects, and so on. So that's one way you could have a mental health effect. As suggested by this tweet fairly recently, a study came out in The Lancet that looked at anxiety, right? And so fear or anxiety can also increase. It might be of catching the disease yourself or of a loved one doing so and dying. There could be post-traumatic stress, of course. There's been several studies that looked at that, in particular with SARS, right, the first SARS. Social isolation, Carla will talk more about this. Bereavement, loss of a family member or friend, for example. Financial and economic losses can impact your self-perception, your quality of life, your ability to get healthcare or other resources. It might make other concerns or worries worse, and so on. And as we've seen with almost every major infectious disease throughout history, different populations are usually blamed for the spread of the disease, and they might be harassed, they might be stigmatized, discriminated, even physically attacked. And of course, that could have mental health impacts as well. So I want to briefly talk about some conditions that were linked to the 1918 flu in particular. All of these are somewhat controversial in the sense that it's really hard to find direct epidemiological connections between them, but they have been linked and studied in various research. So the first one I'll talk about is dementia praecox. This is a term that was popular in the late 19th, early 20th century. It was thought to be a degenerative condition, so getting worse over time, and to begin in the late teens. And one of the researchers at the time, Menninger, was really quite interested in the mental disturbances or psychiatric effects of the 1918 flu. And so he did various studies on people who had been diagnosed with these, including of this 100 people study he looked at, 25 who had been diagnosed with this dementia condition. Following up then, 50 people about 8 years later who were also in the Boston Hospital diagnosed with this condition, he found that 35 of them had completely recovered and 5 of them had been showing improvement. And at the very least, this made him say, we have to reconsider what this diagnosis is, what the prognosis is, it might not be degenerative, and so on. And in fact, this term is no longer used and largely replaced with schizophrenia. Another fairly well-known condition that was researched in relation to the 1918 flu is the encephalitis lethargica epidemic. This was known as sleepy sickness or sleeping sickness, and it occurred in 1917 to the late 1920s. And in adults, this was mostly kind of a physical or bodily effect, but in approximately one-third of children who had this illness, they were described as rapidly transforming in terms of psychiatric and behavioral symptoms, right? Changes, often leading to institutionalization. So some of the symptoms that were associated with this in children were personality changes, agitation, insomnia, impulsiveness, self-mutilation, self-harm, right? And one description of malicious cruelty combined with feigned friendliness. And so symptoms were observed to last about 1 week to maybe 4 months. And again, there's no direct evidence. There's no preserved brain tissue, for example, showing viral fragments that might have affected and caused these changes. But there is some support for connection based on the overlapping time periods and reports at a time that seem to see there was a connection between them. The other one I'll talk about is a kind of a body of work that has looked at later life conditions. So pregnant people who were exposed to the 1918 flu, what happened to those children after they were born later in life? And studies have looked at disability and chronic health, at education, socioeconomic status, all these things that might also impact mental health outcomes too. Other studies have looked at the 1957 flu pandemic, and particularly with schizophrenia. And these are, again, inconsistent. There's one study from Japan, for example, that found that there was an increased risk of schizophrenia among females, but not males, who were exposed in utero. Another study kind of looked at several different ones to see trends and inconsistencies, and they found no support for the overall hypothesis. So these types of things in particular are very hard to prove, right? They're hard to control for. Lots of things could happen in life between being in uterus and then being later developing schizophrenia. So how do you control for those things? And the results typically tend to be quite modest or limited and inconsistent. I'm going to use this idea to talk about my last thing here, which is our next steps, right? So we have examples of anecdotes, single stories of individuals. We have inconsistent results. We have general ideas, but uncertainties, right? And particularly for COVID, we can't yet talk about the long-term impacts, the long-term effects. And so what we'll have to do instead is looking at past or historical pandemics. And we're going to do a systematic review. And for those of you who might be unfamiliar with that, that's a strategic, planned, thorough search and review of different studies. We worked with university librarians here to search 8 databases. We've retrieved 4,436 articles related to the keywords for pandemics, for mental health, for long-term effects, and so on. Our next steps will be to go through these, look at the titles, the abstracts, in some cases read the full articles to see are they actually related. We'll probably end up looking at very few of those 4,000 plus articles in the end. And we're going to look at 5 different pandemics from the last century or so. There's 1889, 1918, 1957, 1968, and 2009. We're going to look at any population or context, but the focus is pandemics, mental health long-term. So things we'll look at in these articles include what types of mental health conditions were observed, if they were actually diagnosed, or if it was more just like general worry, general anxiety, and so on, how long the symptoms lasted, how severe they were, outcomes like death or institutionalization or being put on a disability pension, for example, things like gender and age to try and match those different types of populations, and then also we're not limiting it to specific causes. It might be attributed to or believed to be caused by the disease itself, by loss, by fear, whatever. We're keeping it open to anything that might be related to the overall social and biological effects of pandemics. Some of these, of course, will require judgment calls. So we aren't particularly interested in those in utero exposures. We aren't particularly interested in the cases where people have the flu, for example, and while they're sick, they're pre-existing psychiatric symptoms get worse, but then they get better, right? We're really interested in these kind of, you have the disease and then you continue to have effects after that. But then how long is long-term? We also aren't expecting these to be lifelong, for example. So this is going to be kind of a judgment call in looking at these articles. And the other thing we have to keep in mind, of course, is lots of health conditions could have both psychiatric or mental health impacts and physical health. There's an overlap between those, and so we have to wonder about which ones we're actually including or not in order to make sure that, again, we're being systematic in how we're doing this. So again, this is our next steps. Hopefully we'll have more exciting things to talk about within the next several months on that. But for now, I'm going to hand it over to Carla, who will talk about her master's work on one particular aspect of the 1918 flu.
Thank you, Jessica. Thank you, everybody, as well, for being here this morning and joining us whilst we talk about mental health and pandemics. As somebody with a background in psychology, whenever I'm thinking about research or thesis or work that I'm doing, psychological aspects or outcomes is always something that is in the forefront of my brain when I'm thinking about work. Also then, being an affiliated master's student with the Center for Research on Pandemics and Society, PANSOC, it seemed appropriate to write a master thesis on the association between the 1918 flu pandemic and suicide rates here in Norway. So I'm going to try and paint a picture for you of 100 years ago, 1918, here in Norway. So Håkon the Seventh, he was the king, and Gunnar Knudsen, have to write these down, was the prime minister. And at this time, there is another very significant event happening in the world, and that's the First World War. However, Gunnar and Håkon decided, we're not involved, we're not included in this war at all. They remained very much neutral at that time. However, this doesn't mean that nothing happened in Norway during this time. Something that did happen is the 1918 flu pandemic, sometimes also called the Spanish flu, perhaps unfortunate for the Spanish people, for those living in Spain. It's suggested by some reports it was the Spanish flu because they were the best at spreading the word about the virus, but instead got blamed with spreading the virus. So, what do we do when infection starts to spread? We create rules. Similarly to what we are experiencing at the moment, sneeze into the elbow, we had wash your hands for as long as it takes you to sing happy birthday, all these wonderful rules that we're given. They're not too dissimilar to the rules that they were given in 1918. So don't take a person's breath, keep the mouth and teeth clean, which I would argue should be the case at all times anyway. Avoid those that cough and sneeze. Again, it's not me that's coughing or sneezing, of course not, it's everybody else. So these rules, how do they make you feel? Oh, I can't go to the gym because everything's closed. I can't go to the restaurant because everything's closed. I'm not allowed to hug my grandmother. These things, they impact us in our hearts, in our minds, and they affect our mental health. An unfortunate and very sad aspect of this is that this can lead to poor mental health, which then has the devastating outcome of something such as suicides, which is what I'm going to be looking at in my thesis. So the next question is perhaps why? So obviously living at the moment through the COVID-19 pandemic, this sort of research is of course in high demand. We want to look at what we can do better, and the best way to do that is by looking previously at what we have done, and that's what worked well and perhaps what didn't. One thing that I want to highlight is, of course, to give you a statistic. In 2018, a public health report in Norway reported that between 500 and 600 people per year in Norway take their own lives. With a population of 5.3 million, this one thing I want to highlight is that the mental health of somebody that then takes their own life is not the only person then affected by suicides. There's also those that bereave their lost loved one or grieve somebody that has perhaps taken their own life. However, for my research, I don't have those numbers. I think those numbers are unfortunately much higher than we would all wish they would be. So what I will be looking at is the number of suicides between the years 1910 and 1920. Next, what I wanted to move on to is the motivation for why Norway is of particular interest. Now, I mentioned the king and the prime minister decided we're not being involved in the war, which makes Norway very unique at this time. A lot of research that I've looked at is by a gentleman here named Wasserman. He wrote about suicide rates during the 1918 flu pandemic in the United States, who were obviously very much involved in the First World War. He does, however, suggest that suicides were greatly more affected by the flu pandemic than the coinciding war. But hopefully the research that I will do here in Norway, in a country that remained neutral, will support perhaps that claim that he has made. I'll keep you updated. So then the one thing that I focused on the most in this research is the reduction in social integration as a risk factor. So of course, if we're talking of blame, what is to blame for the changes in suicide rates? Is it the war? Is it the lockdowns? Is it the pandemic itself? Is that stressful? Financial strains, social isolation, job losses, all of these things are, of course, risk factors. However, in this particular research, I'm going to look mostly at social integration and those who were affected. So to give you just some very, very simple preliminary analysis, because this is still ongoing as it's my final year here, I'm going to look at differences between and within municipalities in Norway. So as you know, perhaps in Oslo, there was more strict restrictions than there were in a municipality where maybe only 1,000 people live. So that's something that I wanted to look at. I'm also looking at how many medical professionals there were, doctors or vaccinators. Did it mean that more doctors in that local area meant that people felt more supported with their mental health? Vaccinators, do people feel more encouraged to be looked after during the pandemic itself? I will also look at things like age and gender as an aspect too. And then to look very briefly just at my graph here, this was the same years that we used by Wasserman that I previously mentioned, between 1910 and 1920. At face value, straight away you can see that there is an increase in suicides. However, this graph gives me a lot more questions. Is, okay, the pandemic is 1918. So these increases just here, what is this? Why is this? And how this still increases? Should I look more at the years to follow? These are all very good questions that perhaps I don't have answers to yet. But please feel free to ask any questions at the end. And I hope to present you with some more results once everything is finalized. So yes. That concludes my aspect of the talk. I hope that was enjoyable for you. And now I will pass you over to Nan with her results too. Thank you.
I will start with something different, a story from 1970s. In the beginning of 1970s, there is this professor in psychology and law. He has at Stanford University. He has noticed that several young people, they faked their mental health status in order to skip military services because of the Vietnam War. And that inspired him and gave birth to one of the most famous psychological experiments, that is the Rosenhan experiment. So this is the professor, David Rosenhan. He sent 8 people, including himself, to different psychiatric hospitals, and this is so-called pseudo patients. They pretend that they heard voice and words such as void, hollow, and thud, but none of them had any psychiatric histories. These eight people were diagnosed with mental disorders, and they were hospitalized at once. And right after admission to the hospital, they have actually told the doctors that this was only a part of an experiment. However, they were not believed, and they had to stay at the hospital from between 7 to 52 days. And by release, their release diagnosis was the same as the admission, but only in remission. So after the study was published in 1973, there was this hospital that was offended, and they challenged Dr. David Rosenham and asked him to send more pseudo patients to their hospitals. And they said that our stuff would be able to detect who were the pseudo patients that pretended to be ill. So Rosenham agreed, and in the following weeks, the stuffs identified 41 out of 250 new patients as potential pseudo patients, and in fact, Rosenham, he didn't send anyone. So although this experiment was controversial, but it showed the uncertainty of diagnosing mental illnesses. So this is an experiment that was conducted to test the reliability and validity of psychiatric diagnosis. And Rosenhan argued that mental illnesses are manifested as a result of societal influences. At Penzoc Center, we have also conducted several studies on mental health problems, but instead of using psychiatric instruments or psychometrics, we were using social factors such as socioeconomic status, demographics, and social epidemiological aspects. And of course, we have done this study to study how people's mental health status was during the pandemic compared to the period before the pandemic. Next. Yes. So this is the first one. We have predicted our mental health indicators based on social factors. And in one of the studies, we have, instead of using mental disorders or mental illnesses, we used other indicators such as psychological well-being or so-called called life satisfaction, which is an indicator which is which has quite high correlation with mental health problems, and it captures a larger range of social groups, and it indicates how people's quality of life has been during the pandemic. The corona pandemic has posed major challenges to our lives, to our psychological well-being and mental health status. For example, a meta-analysis found that during the early stage of the pandemic, already about 30% of the whole population was suffered from depression, and that was in the beginning of the 2020. And in Norway, the prevalence of depression and anxiety was three times higher in 2020 compared to the years before. And in our study, we found that one in four, around 25% of the whole population, showed symptoms of anxiety and depression. More interestingly, our study found that some social groups are at higher risk of mental health problems compared to others. Using data collected from three different time points during the corona pandemic in Norway, we found that younger people, women, the poor, and people with weak labor market ties, they suffered more from depression and psychological distress during the pandemic compared to other social groups. We also found that the most important predictors that have remained quite stable over the whole pandemic period, they were self-perceived exposure risks, income level, ability to comply with non-pharmaceutical intervention, so-called NPI, and contact with family and friends, as well as work-life conflict. We found that exposure risk, that was the most important predictor of depression. And that was actually not equally distributed to different social groups. So think of people who have work and life situations that in which they had higher risks of contacting other people physically. And not all people have these digital competencies as the old people, and not all can afford to buy food from or daily necessities from only online shops. So there are these social inequalities in terms of demographics and socioeconomic backgrounds. And yeah, moreover, social groups are carrying different burdens of mental health problems. And we found that, let's see, women, they are more likely to carry a heavier or larger childcare, and therefore they are facing more challenges in terms of balancing their work life and free times. And students, they're lonely, renting a little apartment in big cities, but only receiving remote lectures. They are more likely to feel lonely. And the unemployed and people who lost their job during the pandemic, they experienced lower self-esteem, higher economic challenges, as well as more worried being for their futures, and experienced the lower life satisfaction. So these inequalities, in turn, lead to more psychological distress and depression. Therefore, social inequalities, they translated and was reinforced by the pandemic and made visible by emotional burdens and mental illnesses. So let's take a closer look at work. We have different words like unemployment and work and job. So we know already that unemployment was one of the most important predictors of lower life satisfaction and depression and mental health problems. So what about those people who were employed during the pandemic? Were they happy? The answer is, it depends. We found that occupation matters. So for those who work within service and sale, and those who had an elementary occupation such as cleaners and helpers, they are more likely to be depressed. Second, health for the employed matters. So we found, using work-life barometer from AFI, we found that people with poorer health, they are more likely to face larger challenges and a more worsened work situation, such as cutbacks or cutoffs. And such worsened work situation further lead to lower life satisfaction. So the pandemic has imposed unpredictable work situations, and the threat of dismissal and temporary layoffs, they are actually not equal for all. And for those who had poor health, who had insecure job from before, lower socioeconomic status and lower income, those groups are mostly challenged by the labor market, and they had lower life satisfaction and higher risks of being depressed. So in other words, those who already were vulnerable before the pandemic, they became actually more vulnerable after the pandemic compared to before and compared to other social groups. So in sum, although the pandemic has challenged our mental health status, but the challenge was not equal for all. So socioeconomic status has posed different difficulty levels of this game of pandemic. And healthy people with higher income, stable job, living within a household with others, such as couples with or without children, they are the winners of the game. So they are more happier with their life, and they have lower risks of being depressed or having mental health problems compared to those with lower income, unemployed, had an insecure work, being single, or with poor health. Yeah. As proposed in the beginning of my presentation, mental illnesses are manifested as a result of societal influences. Our study used socioeconomic factors to predict mental health status and achieve the desirable results in terms of accuracy and precision. This may help stakeholders to develop a first-hand screening to detect potential mental health problems based on social aspects in people's daily life. As it is important to detect depression and mental illness in an early stage, such predictive tool may help to improve timely preventive interventions. Furthermore, Instead of mainly focusing on treatment, it is also more important to look at preventive measures. Preventive measures, which target at those vulnerable social groups. This is to reduce the risks of being severely ill. Such interventions might be, for example, to provide a more secure and predictable work situation for those with poor health, for those with weak ties to labor market, and for those with lower socioeconomic status. This can be especially important in a more insecure social situation such as the pandemic. So to reduce mental health illnesses goes hand in hand with reducing social inequalities. I would like to end this presentation with a quote from Michael Marmot. Health inequalities and the social determinants of health are not a footnote to the determinants of health. They are the main reasons. Thank you.
You referred to suicides and to due to the Spanish flu and perhaps due to the World War I, which Norway didn't take part in. Have you looked into suicides during World War II when we were occupied?
No, but that's a fantastic idea. I think most of the only other thing then is perhaps I can't compare it with the pandemic as well, I suppose. Yeah. But I'm not entirely sure how involved Norway was with the Second World War. Forgive me, I'm not entirely positive with your history. Yeah. All I know of is the attempted attacks to your king, again, the same king, right? Haakon the VII.
Yeah, but we were occupied during 5 years,
yes.
So...
Yeah. Yeah. But that's a really great point. Thank you. No, I hadn't thought of that.
And then I thought, and that's a methodological question to all of the presentations. You are studying the effects of pandemics. And then we have people who have studied the mental and physical health effects of war. Can you use some of the results from this research? One could think that it's not really what you experience that's the problem, but being left alone with your traumas, that's perhaps more important. So we're studying a country under occupation, or like we had in Norway, sailors who came back with experiences that they were left alone with, that had more impact on their psychical health. Could you use some of that research, you think?
Yes, I think so, and this isn't perhaps a direct answer to your question, but I think it is really important to think about historical context. So if we're thinking about, you really cannot talk about the 1918 flu without talking about World War I. Right? You really cannot talk about COVID without talking about things like the US presidential election, massive protests. All of these things go hand in hand, partly because they're caused by it. People are not protesting lockdowns if there weren't any lockdowns, right? They have to have occurred. But then these protests could also potentially lead to transmission, and it all gets tied in hand. So you really cannot avoid, and I think that's one of the big points of our center as a whole, is that you can't just look at the medical factors, you can't just look at the virus, you have to think about what's happening in society at the time. And I don't know if it's necessarily like a good attitude to think about, can we control for that? Can we limit out the effects and just identify the effects of mental health, for example? Because it's all tied together, and it's really hard to say that one thing is caused by the other, and if we could just get rid of this one part, then we wouldn't see it. So I think you have to think about all those factors. Yeah.
No, so my name is Sven-Erik Mamlund. I'm a professor here at Oslo Met in pandemic studies and head of PANSOC. I have a little bit of a question thinking about your presentations. Thank you so much. They were all three very awesome. Is there any evidence or papers out, and this question goes to Nan, about people getting less treatment during COVID, you know, because of the lockdowns? And have you seen any, you know, studies thinking about that as an explanation for more mental health problems during COVID? And for Jessica, is there any evidence out in the literature on the 1918 flu pandemic on people getting less treatment for mental health issues during the pandemic? I don't know, maybe at the family level or at the institutions or in the larger society?
Yes, I see some studies showing that during the pandemic, most of the facilities was used to treat patients due to the coronavirus. And of course, that leads to some lower treatment rates for other disease, including mental health disease and mental health disorders. But I don't have numbers about or studies that explored if it has some effects on the mental health or increased mental health problems during the pandemic. But definitely, it would be an issue, and it would be very interesting to study in the future studies.
Like I said, to my knowledge, our study was the first on disparities for mental health during the 1918 flu. I'm not aware of any other studies that have looked at specifically mental health and treatment. I'm also not particularly aware of like statistics in terms of just any type of healthcare availability or resources during the pandemic as a result of, you know, I'm assuming it's going to be very similar in terms of what we see now, where there's going to be overwhelming numbers and not enough beds in hospitals and so on. But in terms of mental health, healthcare resources and so on, none that I know of. If we look at individual schools for children with disabilities in Norway, the reports on those, for example, there was often discussion of what was done during epidemics and how they would deal with those. And in some cases, if there was enough room, any affected students would go into, for example, a hospital or an isolation ward. During a tuberculosis epidemic at one school, the students were moved from the school to the tuberculosis hospital. And then in some cases, they would shut down the school and send the students back to their homes, which of course could also lead to more transmission of disease within the larger communities because they're leaving the center and moving out on trains and boats and so on back home. So in some cases then, most of the stuff that I can talk about is how the response to the pandemic might have led to more infectious disease transmission and less about how it would have been treated in terms of mental health. Just kind of talking more about what Nan was bringing up also about societal influences and historical diagnoses and so on, you know, we and some of the things I mentioned too is that the terms that were used back then don't necessarily match up to conditions that we might have now too. So, and they might not necessarily even have real, quote-unquote, real treatments that would have been effective anyway, so.
For Carla, you said that that Norway remained neutral in World War I, but then the flu pandemic also happened, and we saw an increase in your graph of suicide rates. So do you have any ideas of why remaining neutral, the suicide rates went up anyhow?
That's the whole idea of my research, basically. There is some indication that the reason I focus mostly on social integration is because there is some indication that an absolute reduction in social integration can increase suicides. Equally, there is some indication that an increase in social integration, therefore opening of society, can also have a similar effect. You've been locked down for, in some cases, as we've seen, what feels like years. And that introduction back into society can be equally as overwhelming, which is possibly one of the ideas that I had for why the graph continues to increase. That may have something to do with that. But that's a really good question and one that I hope to answer for you in the next few months.
It's so good presentations. You need good chocolate. Oh. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Wonderful.